What's up, fellas? Welcome to... Oh, what the fuck? What do you always say? Welcome to the next episode of the Mint Mob Podcast. Alex here, joined by my buddy Jason from across the pond in the United States. That was pretty good, right?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. What you always say. It's kind of funny, right? Like when you get put on the spot.
Absolutely, yeah. We are about to jump into the most recent topics crypto-wise. We'll jump into NFTs, Goodfellas. We've actually not spoken for 2 weeks now. Unfortunately, last week we weren't able to have a podcast episode. Last week we were kind of rocked on X Spaces. So hopefully this week everything goes back to normal, right?
Yeah, let's hope so. And if you're worrying about the intro, we were just joking before we started recording that it had been so long since we spoke that I'd forgotten the intro. And Alex was like, well, I can remember the intro. So you see, it's not as easy as it sounds, right?
Yeah, it's not. I think you need to get used to it. Give me two more times and I'll sound like I've never done anything else. Yeah, but let's jump a little bit into what's been going on in crypto. And there was actually a pretty big thing happening 2 or 3 weeks ago. Don't want to talk about old news, obviously, but there was a pretty interesting discussion going on. There was a hack on Drift Protocol. I'm not sure if you guys have seen that. Drift Protocol is a protocol that runs on Solana, which does not mean Solana was affected, but the protocol was actually experiencing a, like, people called it like a full stack exploit, because it all started with social engineering. That's what most exploits start with. Attackers, I think they prepared for weeks and months, and they targeted multisig signers and they tricked them into approving transactions they did not fully understand. And that way they got admin level control, which gave them the possibility to create a completely fake token. I think they manipulated its price and they used it as a collateral. So Drift thought the value of the token was really high, hundreds of millions, and they were able to borrow real assets, and they extracted, I think, almost like 300 million USDC. I think it was around 280 million. And yeah, that's basically what happened. And the discussion that was going on was actually about Circle. Circle is the company that issues USDC. And their role was that a large portion of those stolen funds, as I mentioned, ended up in USDC. And those funds were moved across, you know, multiple chains, and they were visible on chain for multiple hours. And the main accusation against Circle was they had a lot of time and they didn't do anything. So people claim that they got messaged and got notified that there is something fishy going on you know, their bridges. And as I mentioned, that exploit was, you know, going on and funds were moved over multiple hours, a lot of transactions, and they had a pretty big time window to react. So we all know that Circle actually has the power to freeze wallets, but they didn't use it. We've seen that actually in the past when Circle froze funds, in a famous tornado cash exploit. I think that did need like a law enforcement request and a court order, and this time they didn't do anything, and people were like, okay, should Circle be able to freeze funds when it's required or not? And that was a pretty big discussion, a lot of pros and cons. But first, I'd like to know from you, Jason, what do you think?
Well, I mean, what do I think about which part? I mean, are you talking about the demand that Circle do something, or, you know, the exploit, or what specifically part of it are you referring to? There's a lot there, actually.
Do you feel like we need an additional security layer, and a company like Circle should have the possibility, or... Yeah, should be able to just freeze wallets when they see something, you know, sketchy going on chain and they feel like this could be a hack?
I think it depends on the business itself. I mean, if you transact on a centralized exchange like Coinbase, for example, or Binance, or you know, whoever you happen to use, you'll notice that at certain times they'll freeze your account, they'll freeze your wallets, and they have full control of your wallet and keys. And that's part of the, you know, that's part of the trade-off. Like you don't have to worry about managing your wallet and keys. They do that for you. But the trade-off is, you know, you have no control and they can give you or not give you your funds as they see fit, right? And the whole idea behind crypto was that, you know, you don't have to rely on a third party to necessarily transact. So if you're dealing with a company like Circle, in this particular case, Circle acted as a bridge between Solana and Ethereum to get the USDC mm-hmm. from Solana to Ethereum. And, you know, moving the funds to Ethereum made it much, much harder to track. So the thing is, do you want to be associated with or do business with a organization that can stop transactions based on what it sees, or do you not? And I think as an individual, you should have that choice. So if Circle, and they've acted in the past based on, like you said, I don't know if, well, you may have mentioned this off mic, but they've acted in the past to stop transactions based on like law enforcement requests or court orders. But that didn't happen in this case. But this happened way too fast for any of that to take place. So, you know, do you want them to have the authority to just simply say, well, we're not going to process this transaction, even though it looks legitimate, which is what was happening. Like all these transactions look legitimate because they were, again, the product of a social engineering exploit, not a protocol level exploit. That opens a lot of, you know, crazy doors to, you know, censorship and who decides. The whole idea behind crypto was that no one decides but you. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't, you know, say I want it this way when it's going my, you know, when everything's turning up roses and it's going my way, but I want it the other way when it's going against me. It doesn't work that way. Like you get one set of rules, and if you choose into that set of rules, then you play by that game. You play that game by that set of rules. So I feel like if you want to blame Circle, or if you want to blame platform X or protocol Y, then you should understand how those protocols and platforms work before you decide to do any form of business with them. And since Circle issues USDC, you know, I mean, if the attacker chooses that token to transact in, then of course it's going to be very difficult for, you know, like, you know, USDC or Circle in this case to be like the arbiter of truth, because again, the transactions looked legitimate. So, I mean, do you have the same expectation of the tokens that were converted to Solana and the tokens that were converted to Ethereum? Do you have the same expectation that Solana should limit transactions or that Ethereum should limit transactions, or should it only be at the protocol level that rides on top of those chains? Right. So like you have all these different questions that you can ask, but I think really it just comes down to, as a company, this is a company or token or a platform that I want to use. These are their rules. And if I choose to, you know, opt in and play the game using their set of rules, then that set of rules applies to all transactions, both positive and negative. Man, I hit the jackpot on that one.
Yeah, good. Yeah, good point. Good point. But one part of the discussion was actually also, like, if you look at these kind of things, I mean, we've seen social engineering so many times in crypto, and we've seen so many posts on X of people losing their funds because, you know, they clicked on a wrong link or they trusted someone who, I don't know, who got like a compromised account or something. So like we keep speaking about crypto adoption and, you know, payments over crypto will be the future and all that stuff. But do you feel like, is it like, can we say like ethical? Can we say that? Let me think a second. Like, is it ethical to onboard like new users into a system where like one mistake can equal a total loss? Right, because obviously people are used to have like that kind of security layer that everything is kind of, yeah, almost like reversible. And crypto obviously, like it's different. So if we want to onboard new users and people being able to pay in crypto, and you know, obviously, do we need protection for those people, or do you feel like you just said it right? Like you said, if you want to use a system where you know the rules and you know that once you do a mistake that can lead into a total loss, you need to accept it. Or like, do you feel like that is that is suitable for, you know, for payments and like broader systems for the whole population, basically?
It's always this way in reality. We abstract these layers on top of reality to make us feel better. You know, like
one example. Like, I'm not sure of how it's in the United States, but for example, as you know, I'm in the car business, right? So if I buy a car somewhere and I receive a transaction from, let's say, Lithuania, right? Like, you know, the country Baltic State, Lithuania. And when I receive a transaction from my bank or I pay something to them, I get like a security mail, and they ask me like, "Hey, is that legit or not? Because it's like an unusual transaction for your account history." So they are some kind of security layer trying to protect me, and that obviously doesn't happen on crypto, right? Like if you just insert like an address, like a Solana address or Bitcoin or whatever, the money is gone forever. So to some degree, it's actually like there is an additional layer of safety in like the banking system. But yeah, that's just one thing I wanted to add.
Yeah, you're 100% right. I mean, but again, like, how are you defining safety? In this particular case, you're defining safety as insurance. Yeah, I have an insurance guarantee that this third party is going to arbitrate but on my behalf that this transaction is actually legitimate, right? And so basically what you're doing is you're outsourcing your responsibility. You're saying, okay, I'm willing to put up with all of the bullshit documentation, you know, anti-money laundering, you know, paperwork and schemes and scams that the bank and the government have set up. I'm willing to deal with all that in exchange for having the security of, or the insurance guarantee of, this transaction being legitimate, right? So you've created that trade-off, and we've all done this with the banking system. And, you know, here in the US, it's no different. You know, if you have money on deposit with the banks are insured. An FDIC bank, a Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation bank, insures your funds up to like $250,000 or something like that, right? And so we submit ourselves to the outsourcing of the responsibility because it's much easier for us to transact in most cases that way. But if you are an individual who's moving a lot of money, that doesn't work for you, right? If you need to, like, if I needed to send you $10,000 today from my bank, I would have to go to the bank. I would have to fill out a bunch of forms. I'd have to get wiring information from you. I'd have to give that to my bank. They'd have to verify that with your bank. And then maybe in 3 days you would get the funds, assuming that the government didn't interrupt the transaction. Right. Or I could just send you.
You sure it's so difficult? You should try. You should try, man.
Yeah. Or I could just send you, $10,000 in Solana, right? Like, here's $10,000 worth of Solana and it's there. In one case, I'm responsible for the transaction. In the other case, the banking system itself is responsible for the transaction. If something goes wrong, then I have recourse. So the only difference is how much responsibility I want to have as an individual. So I think that...
Absolutely, but
here's the thing. Here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. Here's the thing, right? If I'm confident in my ability to move money and I'm willing to take the risk, then I don't want anyone to intervene on my behalf. But that's not to say that we couldn't develop a series of wallets that had these protections built in, just like we have hardware wallets, right, that have these protections built in. We could build digital wallets that have these protections built in. Like, if this wallet has, you know, this extra digit at the end, or if this wallet, you know, resolves to this particular key, then on this particular transaction, there's a third party that has to approve it, right? Which is basically what, you know, we've set up in the form of like 2 out of 5, you know, 2 out of 5 signer wallets have to sign the transaction, or, you know, my ledger has to, you know, be connected and then I have to approve the transaction twice on ledger or whatever. Like, we've already built these schemes in, right? But if you choose to participate in a system that doesn't allow for that, then you can't come back retroactively when a transaction doesn't go your way and say, oh, they should have done this or they should have done that. No, motherfucker, you should have done this and you should have done that. Like, you should have set up the protections that you wanted, right? But when people start asking for like protocol level protections, then you have to realize that filters down to all of the people, responsible party or not, who do or don't want to participate in that stuff. So I think that there should be options. And I think that, you know, whatever wallet system you choose, transaction system you use, transaction platform you use, should give you the ability to opt into those protections or not. Because again, once you've opted in, the responsibility is no longer yours, but neither are the funds really, because someone else is controlling your wallet.
I think 2 days ago, I read a post from someone who had his retirement money in Bitcoin, 5.2 or 5.4 Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And he set up a new ledger and he downloaded the ledger app from the Apple store. Is it called Apple Store or is it like iStore? I don't even know. But like the official Apple Store. Mm-hmm. And it was a fake app and it's still online. And everything got drained. He lost his funds. Mm. Obviously, he asked for donations, as always. But yeah, like he was basically like, we are pushing adoption faster than we are building safety, and that is a problem. And that's actually quite interesting because, you know, is it actually realistic for the average person to, you know, have everything in self custody? Or yeah, as you, I mean, you mentioned it, right? Like there are already possibilities to make things safer, but can we expect that from anyone new entering the space?
There's no way to have a new space that's safe. It doesn't work that way. You know, like for example, right now we have SpaceX and NASA. Like NASA's on a moon mission right now, or maybe they came back recently, but they were on a mission to circle the moon and come back, right? And SpaceX is on a mission to actually establish a colony on Mars, right? So these mm-hmm. people are going to be the first ever to do this type of thing, to like build a community on Mars, right? There is no safety for these people, right? They either succeed or they fail, but there's no middle ground. There's no like contingency plan, you know, like because you're 250,000 miles from Earth or whatever it is, you know, like, There's no coming back home, you know, if something goes wrong, you know, so we would have to, you know, try to rescue them with another capsule or another, you know, flight or something like that. But once the colony is established and you've got mechanics on hand and you've got materials on hand and you've got electrical engineers and computer engineers and you've got robots and, you know, AI all running inside the colony, now you have somewhat of a contingency plan, because if something breaks mid-flight, if you're able to land or get near the moon, you might be able to actually connect with someone there who can actually help get you landed on the moon or get you back to Earth, right? And the point I'm trying to make is like, when you first start your expansion and you go into exploring new areas, there's literally no way to create safety. The safety comes after the people come to the new space. And that's what's happening now. So we've had enough people in the space who have entered this new frontier. You know, we've had enough cowboys take arrows in the back, so to speak, that now it's a little bit safer. We've got the ledger. We've got this, that, the other thing. We've got multi-sig wallets. And that'll continue to evolve to, like I said, systems where you can opt into like third-party protections, I think, right? But that only happens because adoption happened first. It doesn't come in the other way. It doesn't come in the opposite order. And so, you know, as much as it sucks, and speaking as someone who has been drained, like for a tremendous amount of money, you know, like I get the pain. Like I have felt it firsthand, and I certainly wouldn't wish that on anyone. But by the same token, if I'm going to play in a decentralized land where, you know, things are my responsibility, then I have to own the fact that basically I created the result. And although it wasn't a great result, mm-hmm. you know, I did learn a valuable lesson, one that I can apply to future earnings. And I still want to be able to go into that decentralized space and trade or swap or hold funds outside of the banking system so that I have some autonomy. And I wouldn't want a third party to be able to limit me, right? So for me personally, even though I've been a victim of this, I do want the ability to live in that space. And I also want the ability for people who choose to opt into greater safeties to have those options. So I think that's what I would consider setting up if I were building a new wallet or a wallet that was meant to be like safety specific. Like, how could I set this up? How could I filter this wallet or create a series of wallets that acts or behaves differently or that is run or controlled by a third party, even though, you know, I might hold the keys, you know? So I think all of those possibilities exist, but it needs to be optional, not mandatory.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mentioned that before we jumped onto that discussion. I think I said that in the meeting we had before that we are actually on the same page when it comes to that discussion, obviously. But it's always interesting to see all these different opinions, and people are like, yeah, I mean, it's like when people enter the space and they all see all these posts from people losing their funds. I mean, we see, like, since I came into crypto, I've seen these posts, right? Like the methods have changed. Like, scammers do different things. I remember back in the days when we had the first NFT scams, mm-hmm. it was always like on mint days, they just created like a fake website where you clicked and connected your wallet and signed a transaction, and suddenly your wallet was drained. Happened to me as well. I think I lost like $100 on some fake mint. And, you know, you learned from that, obviously.
Right.
And then you see all the things happening to people on CT. Sometimes it's like social engineering. Sometimes it's clicking a fake link. And you get cautious over time, of course. Like, whenever I send money, like I double, triple check whenever I send bigger amounts of crypto to my ledger or to different wallets. And yeah, as you said, like, the market matures and adoption happened before, you know, all these kind of things. So let's see where we go. But I don't think we can accuse Circle of doing anything wrong here. And yeah, but still, it's like, it's interesting to see that there are even crypto people who feel like there should be an additional security layer. But yeah, let's move on. There was another really interesting thing happening in the NFT space, because I read that Yuga Labs is the famous creator of the NFT collection Bored Apes. Oh, by the way, before we jump into that lawsuit, I've seen some community members. I think Metalhead and Jilly bought a mutant ape, and Jilly made a post and she said that she mainly did that for the culture. You know, they were basically one of the first big collections that we ever had. Would you buy an ape for the culture?
Yeah, but I would want the original version, not the mutant version. So yeah, but mm-hmm. for sure,
like,
yeah,
the bored one.
Yeah, the actual original one is the bored ape. The mutants came later, and then they had the pets, and then they have the other side. You know, like virtual world. There's a bunch of different bits of the collection that you can purchase, land as well, like all kinds of different things. But yeah, mm-hmm. if it were me, I would purchase the original piece. That's the one that started it all, I think, for IP, really.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember if we look at Solana, for example, right? Like, we know that there has been that one collection that kind of reigned the Solana tier list for quite some time, the DE gods. I don't think they are on top anymore, but I remember that at some point I felt like I should get one. I know you got a couple, and then I think they released the second collection. How was it called? Like the furry, give me a second, how was it called? Utes, exactly. Yeah, Utes. And I was also thinking about getting a Ute. I remember back then when they were at, like, I think $1,500 was like the floor price. I didn't get one. Last time I checked a couple of weeks ago, they were at like $80.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if I wanted to get one, I'd probably also want to get a Bored Ape, because that's like 2020, 2021 vibes. Ethereum, absolutely flagship collection. And I'm not sure if I like the art, because, you know, there were so many copycats, and I've seen that art so many times that it kind of started to actually bore me. but yeah, like, definitely a pretty cool one. And that's pretty interesting, because that's all what the lawsuit was about, because we had another group. What the fuck was their name? RR. They're always called RR. Ripley, something with Ripley. Give me 1 second, I can find out. Ryder Rips. So there was a creator, or I think the creator on X was called Ryder Rips,
mm-hmm.
and he made a copycat collection of the Bored Apes, and it was not like a derivative. It was actually just copy pasted the Bored Apes, and Yuga Labs, of course, said these copies are stealing our brand and confusing buyers, And the other side claimed, no, it's just like it's parody, it's art, it's like it's a protest. And, you know, there is free speech, so we can do that. And the court case went for a really long time, actually. It settled in April, the beginning of April. And there was no big final court verdict, but I think they had an like agreement or something. Let me just try if I actually find what the settlement was, how they settled all that.
Yeah, the settlement was for I think a little over $1 million, $1.5 million, I believe they settled out of court for, and of course with total costs ballooning, I think the case mm-hmm. has gone on for more than 2 years. The total, mm-hmm. you know, estimated costs are something like $8 or $9 million just to fight the lawsuit, right? So this directly ties into the IP conversations we've been having. And one of the reasons that we have to get documentation on everything and understand what we're doing is because at the end of the day, if you start to go into the realm of creating and using characters that you purchase as NFTs, you have to realize that unless you carry rights with those characters, you're not going to be able to do anything with them. And so what's happened in this mm-hmm. particular case, this writer Rips and I think his partner, I forget his name, Jeremy something, they basically ripped off the Bored Apes original IP, as did so many others. Like, they're not the only one, but they're probably just the most notorious or well-known people that ripped them off. And so really all Yuga needed to do was beat these guys, because if they beat these guys or win this particular case, and in this case, I would call it a win because they won the settlement, basically. It basically sends a message to everyone else that's fucking with their IP not to fuck with their IP, right? And so when you are looking at the landscape, this was a huge nod to understanding how IP works. And so what the courts actually did was they granted a permanent injunction, meaning that Rips and Jeremy, what is his last name, Cahan or Cohen or something like that, they're permanently barred. Like, they cannot use anything Yuga Labs related or at all ever, like forever until the end of time, right? And then all of the things that they did create, they have to turn over to Yuga Labs. So not only did they lose the case and have to settle out of court, they also had to give all the assets and domain names and everything that they had used to promote this brand and turn it over to Yuga Labs so that Yuga Labs could either capitalize on it or shut it down. It would be their property, basically, to decide what to do with. And so, you know, with so many knockoff fucking monkey collections out there and so many knockoff BAYC collections out there, people who have created this, you know, are now on notice. Because, like, if you spend years and years and years building on someone else's imagery, even though it may not be exactly the same, but it's close enough to where you could have a result like this, you basically run the risk of losing literally everything you've created. Like, in this particular case, these guys are turning everything over, which basically means that they had no leg to stand on when it came to, you know, the legal battle, or they would have fought for much longer and kept this thing going out. So when you look at it, how it shaked out, Yuga Labs really only needed this win to send a message to everybody else in the market that actually had ripped these things off, right? And this is huge. So hopefully, you know, as more and more stuff like this, you know, comes into being and people start thinking about, okay, well, I purchased this NFT. I have plans to, you know, create a character or create a comic strip or create a cartoon or, you know, some form of animation that I can monetize in the future. Hopefully they'll think twice about, okay, what is it that I'm actually purchasing here? Am I just purchasing display rights? You know, like, I can hang it up somewhere, or am I purchasing commercial rights? Can I make posters? Can I make comics? Can I do t-shirts? You know, whatever that thing is, like, they really need to understand, right? And so this is going to send even further ripple effects to people who actually care about building a business to understand that they need to put forth proper documentation on their websites and on the pieces that they own and control, so that they can properly inform their purchasers what it is that they're getting and have, like, clear expectations on both sides of the transaction. And this is something that we've not really had, because no one really questioned it and NFTs kind of fell back out of favor, you know, in the market. But again, all this stuff cycles and we'll come back around. So right now, if you're acquiring IP, which is what we are doing, we want to make sure that we either have, you know, origin, some sort of tie to the origin or some like clear delineation that this artwork was abandoned and it's just part of the public space, right? But yeah, this is absolutely huge and people should definitely read the case and understand why it happened.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And people should listen back to the IP episode we did with Metalhead Scott on Spaces, where we, you know, basically broke down how real IP agreements need to look like and why it's important for NFTs. And as you said, right, like the Yuga Labs case is going to set precedent for future NFT lawsuits, right? Like that will be used whenever there will be copycat collections or Web3 branding cases. And this proved that they are protected brands and copying them for profit will get you sued. And it's so good, right? Like they are basically doing a pretty important job already for future NFT collections who actually take care of IP and try to set everything the way we do, for example, right? And yeah, I hope that if you look at the amount of conversations we have about IP rights and, you know, try to tell people about the importance of it, that some of them will actually follow our example, right? Like there are so many great people in this space and there are so few of them actually care about IP and setting up proper agreements. I mean, we have been speaking about that for so long now and I'm not aware of anyone out there, even the guys we are in touch with, that they're actually, you know, taking care of it and kind of, you know, up their IP game. That's unfortunate, but I feel like if you actually want to build something sustainable and for the long term, you will need that. And yeah, love what Yuga Labs do, right? Like I had, and that's one reason I feel like they're actually a serious company and why I would even consider owning a Bored Ape in case they dump a little more. I don't even know what the floor price is right now. I think it's around 15,000 or something, but I love that, you know, whenever you own an ape, you can do with the IP whatever you want, right? Like I can open a coffee shop with my Bored Ape and no one can do anything about it because, you know, you got the rights and great job they do. I know there are a couple of projects who pay attention to IP as well, but you can be always for sure that whenever you mint something in the Goodfellas ecosystem, you usually get IP as well. And that's great. You acquired 3 more collections, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a possibility for people to... I'm not sure, did we speak about that already? Or maybe you can summarize what's in for people with those 3 collections.
Yeah, for sure. So there's, obviously there are a lot of bad neighborhoods on chain right now. And when I say that, what I mean is like chains that are really struggling. You know, a lot of the Cosmos chains are struggling. Polygon is really struggling. A lot of the ETH L2s are really struggling. But Polygon is one of the chains that has been sort of made its name for having good art. And though the token has been struggling mightily, there's still a lot of creators there who, you know, did good work and basically abandoned it for whatever reason, either, you know, monetarily it didn't make sense or they moved on to other things. And so there's a collector from another collection who was a whale in 3 collections on Polygon that we managed to get control of. And so I negotiated with him to take over the contracts from ETH and was able to download the data and the imagery from like an OpenSea cache, because a lot of the images were not pinned on storage on the Ethereum, on the ETH L2 side of things, the Polygon side of things. So those images are no longer in the IPFS. So I got all these collections and basically what we are doing is building an IP rights based business. Like in other words, we want to be able to license imagery out to different people for different purposes over time and continue to grow the collection of pieces that we hold. And this is just one more step in the chain there. So with these particular collections, anyone who's holding a family or holding a boss will be able to actually buy into royalty rights on these particular collections. So we'll re-release the art and like help some of the previous collectors who come in. We'll swap some pieces, but we'll leave Mint open for all the other pieces. And those pieces, as they trade hands, will basically send small, tiny little royalty payments to people who are, holding royalty rights. So this basically one of these opportunities to actually monetize what some might consider dead art, And there's a ton of collections on chain that are going to continue to become, dead art, right? And like as long as we can either locate the artist or get access to the contracts and have some sort of guarantee that the contracts or the work was work for hire, like in this case, this was basically work for hire. We can pretty much, get to this place where we can grant IP to holders. But even if we can't, in the cases where artists can't be located, we can grant royalty payments to owners. So this is really kind of a cool thing. And it's something that we talked about in the very beginning of the Goodfellas project, actually really, really early on before we started going to this consolidation phase. So it's kind of fun to see it start to play out. And so right now we've got those three collections, plus there's actually another collection that we haven't done anything with yet because we've been so busy with other things. But we've got like a total of four collections right now that we could release and offer up like royalty slots to at least five wallets who want to participate on each. So five wallets per collection.
Yeah, sounds pretty cool. And I totally remember that this was actually one of our earliest ideas to acquire art that is basically dead on chain somewhere. And it has always been a challenge to find out who created the art, right? Like you could get, in touch with people who ran the project, but actually getting to the artist behind the art was always a struggle. And I mean, we've learned that most of the artists have never had any kind of agreement with any of the founders. So most of the art out there, most of the projects out there have never really licensed the art they use. So that obviously opens the door for us to actually license the art, right? So I remember that we had that conversation with Francois, the artist behind the Goodfellas. And he said that he created so many different collections, but he never, like founders never asked for any kind of agreement. And that in the end means that he never transferred IP rights. Mm-hmm. And that gives us the chance to actually license all the beautiful art he created and hopefully many more in the future.
Absolutely.
Art-wise, we have something else coming up in 11 days from now, which is a beautiful artist incubator drop created by none other than Artie Toma. You own pieces from her, right? Like I think mm-hmm. just today I saw like a mafia piece that you recently bought, which is pretty cool. Yep. If you guys go to object.com, you can actually see that wide variety of different art styles she has. Really cool stuff. You should definitely check that out. I love that she, I think she describes her own art as dark and light fantasy. Mm-hmm. And if you think about dark fantasy, I feel like that kind of describes the piece she created for the Artist Incubator. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think, when you look at the piece, the thing that I really liked about her artwork is it's when it comes to the digital space, she has like a clear style. Her style is very shiny. Like it has a very shiny look to it in the digital sphere. But it's also highly detailed. So if you zoom in on the piece and you start taking a look at, the textures and the shapes, you'll see that there was a lot of time and energy put into making things look incredible. And, like I say 1,000 times though, like anything done well is art. And, art in this particular case, like using, digital tools to create, a lot of times people skip the details because so much of the, of the artwork itself can be sort of filled in by the tools, like if you need a straight line, the tool will draw a straight line. If you need a perfectly curved line, the tool will straighten out any curves that you have. So a lot of times you see artists kind of get lazy with that. And when you zoom in and you start taking a look at the details, you'll see where, you know, all of that shit has kind of been turned off, and the shading or the texturing or the circles or the shapes won't be exactly perfect. You know, you can tell that they were actually, you know, like human strokes on the piece, which is something that I really appreciate personally.
Absolutely. And we will have her on Spaces on Friday 24. Is it actually 24? That's not possible. Oh, yeah, it is Friday 24, when we have the mint party of her piece. And you should definitely check out her profile, because she recently published a piece, and I think she made a post. Give me one second to find it. Yeah, she said, good morning, 25 hours, 50 minutes, 55,000 strokes. And then she reveals the piece she created, the reverse side of the looking glass. And if you look at that piece, you can actually see the amount of details she puts into her work. And it's just crazy. I think it's a really cool piece. I still prefer the Artist Incubator piece because it's more PFP-ish. But you can see that. I think she even made another post where she said, fuck AI. I made this with my hands. And that's interesting, right? Because when we have artist interviews, I always try to, you know, ask people or artists about what they think about AI. So I'm definitely interested and excited about getting her shot and what she thinks about artists using AI. So yeah, like Jason said, a lot of details, a lot of great stuff she created. Definitely have to get a piece from her for my gallery as well. Actually, shout outs to Metalhead, because I got a customized custom glitch ghoul for my gallery. He created it and named it and everything. I will definitely have to show you guys. And Artist Incubator drop in 11 days. Tamara is going to join us on Spaces, another great addition to the gallery. Looking forward to that. And then after we have done that, we will start preparing for our next legendary Sirens drop. Daria has already given you a glimpse of what she creates right now in her videos. So definitely check out her timeline if you haven't done that yet. I'm actually so excited for the one of ones she's going to create. Unfortunately, we haven't seen anything yet. Did she give you like a glimpse on the one of ones secretly without telling me?
No secrets. I think that her idea with the one of ones is always to have them blindfolded of some sort. So I'm looking for, you know, maybe a blindfolded pieces or some piece where the eye, you know, if there were eyes, they would be obscured. So I think that's really the only thing that I know from at least past conversations that she said she would include. But that's all I know.
Yeah, I love the ones she created for the last batch was actually 190 pieces. So we had two one of ones, and there are two one of ones in the original Sirens batch. I think one of those was created by Daria as well. One was created by Maria. And yeah, from now moving forward, I think there is a pretty high chance that we'll see blindfolded one of ones. I'd love to get one. I think STC owns both the ones she created for the last batch, and I'd definitely love to own one, and can't wait to get more Sirens action going on and get another batch. And this is probably going to be a batch of 200 as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's what it's looking like. So we'll see, and hopefully that is the case, because you know these little batches go really quickly. So I think on the last one I got maybe one piece, and I was wanting to get like 20. So I hope that I can really up my game on this particular mint.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, people love the Sirens, so let's see what's going to happen. So we are all aiming to have that Sirens batch sometime around the end of May, and obviously got some artists lined up for the incubator as well, but for now we are focusing on Tamara. We hope you guys look forward to that too, and this should be it for today. Do we have anything else?
I don't think so, man. I think we're good to go.
Awesome. So we hope that you guys have a great week. We hope that X is not going to rock us on Friday and we can have a regular space again. We hope to see you guys around, of course. And yeah, this is it for today. Have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye. We'll see you.
Take care, guys.